course, our speaker tonight is a famous author, and we have exhausted our supply of his latest book, Monimbo, or Monimbo. But we will have more, and to those of you who want it, we will get it for you or supply it to you. But we have still some copies of The Spike, and we have some available. And those of you who haven't read The Spike and would like to have a copy, you can get it. And if you get it tonight, I don't know if you can get it tonight, but maybe Arno would autograph it for you. Let me see. I guess with all of that out of the way, I'm going to turn the task of introducing our speaker for the night over to a man that those of you who are here this afternoon have already heard from, and many of you know him. He's been an associate of ours, an assistant, a valued associate at Accuracy and Media for many years. But he's more than that. If you know from hearing him this afternoon, he is an individual who's had a tremendous career in fighting, and I mean literally fighting. I'm not talking about fighting in an intellectual sense. I'm talking about fighting with guns. And first the Japanese in China as a guerrilla leader. Then you heard him talk this afternoon about his organization of the counterinsurgency group, the Sea Swallows, in Vietnam, giving advice to Ngo Dinh Diem, a lecturer for many years at the down at Eglin Field at the for the Air Force on counterinsurgency, and one who, whatever you may say about this gentleman, he is a man who understands psychological warfare and has come up with some of the most brilliant ideas to advance our cause. He's a man who really is imaginative and a thinker, and that is something that we very much need today. But he is going to introduce our piece de resistance tonight, as I said earlier. I give you now Bernie Yo.
Thank you, Reed. To introduce the speaker tonight is very easy because there's a long list of achievements. As a journalist, as a world traveler, as a man who has interviewed most of the newsworthy personalities in the political field in all over the world. But I'm not going to that, because I'm sure you have read his book and have read his biography about the 25 years as in the Newsweek magazine and so on. I like to put a little personal touch into it because I've admired him for many, many years. In my travels around the world, sometimes in many countries you cannot get English language newspapers. Even if you can get it, it's not very good and not very informative. So I used to rely heavily on the news magazines, the Time and Newsweek. And I always noticed the byline of Arno de Borgraaf in the Newsweek, and it's always informative, always firsthand, very intimate. And you really can get the insight of what's going on in these countries usually through the eyes, ears, and hearts and minds of these leaders. But in the last few years, it's more important than just being an informative journalist. I discovered the depth of understanding about this man in the problem of communism. Now, in our world today, if we look at the journalist, what is the most important thing that the journalist must have, must possess? And that one thing is the understanding of communism, because that is the only thing the only force, the only threat we have in this world today. All the other things are so unimportant comparing to that issue. To understand that, it also requires a person of absolute integrity. Because if you are not honest with yourself, you cannot see through all these complex and very devious, very sort of imaginative things that they are doing all over the world. Our speaker tonight is, in fact, the only journalist that I know of that you can precisely fit that role a journalist should have today. A man of integrity, a truly man with vision about the world, because he has been everywhere. And people usually call a journalist at that level a world-class journalist. Yes, as far as I'm concerned, he is the only truly world-class journalist, Mr. Arnold de Borgraaf.
Thank you so much, Bernie. That's a very tough introduction to live up to. You'll forgive me if I'm a little weary this evening. I left for San Francisco yesterday to give a talk there last night and came back on the red eye and sat down this afternoon to try to collect my thoughts on Vietnam going back some 30 years. I read recently that Americans encounter some 1,600 messages a day. That's political, economic, financial, sexual, and a host of others. But fewer than 15 evoke some kind of reaction. And I realize that this group has exceeded its quota for the day. And perhaps it's a little presumptuous of me to expect that my message this evening will be one of those 15 that registers. The prestigious London Economist recently pointed out that if all the paper that has been covered with disinformation about the so-called North-South conflict were pulped, recycled, and then sold on behalf of third world countries, they could all buy themselves Exocet missiles. Legions of pseudo-intellectuals, Western and non-Western alike, carefully encouraged by communist disinformation specialists who know how to play the guilt complex like a harpsichord, have seized third world themes as a peg on which to hang very facile and instant anti-American cliches. What has been going on for some time now, quite openly, is the introduction into Western politics in general and US politics in particular of an anti-US radical third world ideology, Jesse Jackson's latest antics in Cuba and Nicaragua being its most recent manifestation. One of the most important elements in this disinformation mosaic has been the growing conviction among journalists and academics that anyone who is a friend of the U.S. and a friend of the U.S. and the Third World is probably not worth having as a friend anyway, whereas any leader who calls himself progressive, socialist, or Marxist, and of course non-aligned, as if there were no contradiction in terms, must by definition enjoy the allegiance of his people. Thus, Go Dinh Diem in Vietnam was the villain, and Ho Chi Minh was the good guy, who had been betrayed by his American friends of World War II. The Stanley Carnos and David Halberstams and Tony Lewis's of the profession believed much of the national liberation theology, or more accurately, mythology, that was carefully nurtured and manipulated by Moscow and Hanoi and their proxies throughout the world. One of their gurus, incidentally, well known to Douglas Pike, was Jean Lacouture, a very famous French journalist and author who blazed many trails in the US media designed to give Hanoi and the National Liberation Front, so-called, the benefit of the doubt and to convey the impression that good old Uncle Ho though a communist, was first and foremost a nationalist who would never buckle under Moscow's dictates. Well, guess what? After the war, Jean Lacouture had the courage to make a full confession about what he'd really been up to during the war. And I quote, "During the war, and when I reported from Hanoi, I conducted myself more as a militant, sympathetic to their cause, than as a journalist, and I deliberately concealed from my readers the Stalinist aspects of that regime of which I was well aware," unquote. Not one of Jean Lacouture's American colleagues has demonstrated the same courage. Instead, they have engaged in censorship by omission, the latest example being the so-called TV history of the Vietnam War. Moreover, they have ridiculed people like Bob Elegant and me for focusing on the role of disinformation and its conveyor belts, the role that they played in our strategic defeat. Even Peter Brestrup, and God knows I've had the highest regard for that gentleman and for his work, Big Story Volume 1 and Big Story Volume 2, even Peter Brestrup, who did 7 years of research on this very scholarly work, could not resist putting me down in a recent Washington Post article, which some of you may have seen, poo-pooing the very notion put forward in the Spike that news persons are manipulated by disinformation specialists. And yet, when you discuss the Spike with KGB defectors, their only objection is that Robert Moss and I understated the truth. I made 28 trips to Vietnam for Newsweek between 1952 in the days of the French and 1979 when I managed to get into Hanoi for the May Day celebrations, hoping to duplicate the interview I did with Pham Van Dong in 1972. And you may recall May 79 was when the Vietnamese were looking for some form of rapprochement with the U.S. as an insurance policy against another attack from the Chinese, as they had received a bloody nose in February of that year on their own border and lost some 15,000 killed. Well, I was not alone in keeping notes on what was happening inside the press corps. After covering the Vietnam War for 7 consecutive years, my friend Ian Ward of the Daily Telegraph of London was finally moved to write from Saigon in 1972 that, and I quote, "Never has distortion by the press reached such limits through both willful and unintentional means, and that as a result, the Western press has emerged as the most effective weapon in Hanoi's arsenal," unquote. A man who covered the war for 7 years. I think the first thing that we have to establish is that we Americans, and I am an American by choice, by adoption, we're not against revolution per se. How could we be, given our own revolution that broke the colonial mold and dismantled the barriers that were holding us back? What all administrations have opposed, some more successfully than others, is the hijacking of a revolution by a tiny minority of Marxists who disinform the media by calling themselves non-aligned socialists, or better still, social democrats, and then proceed to impose a worse form of dictatorship than the one that they overthrew. The fact is that Hanoi triggered guerrilla activity in South Vietnam, manufactured a revolution, and hijacked it all from the very beginning. Throughout the 1960s, the North Vietnamese and their NLF puppets convinced most of the non-communist world that the insurgency in the South was the work of an autonomous, spontaneous uprising against the oppression of the Diem regime. Hanoi also insisted it was not intervening in Laos and Cambodia, and our media stars gave Hanoi the benefit of the doubt and went along with a very successful disinformation campaign. Since our defeat in Vietnam, and as recently as February 1983, Vietnamese officials have bragged that they deceived the West throughout the conflict. General Giap, the former commander-in-chief and defense minister, and General Vo Bam explained on French TV that the decision to unleash an armed revolt against the Saigon government was taken by the Central Committee of the North Vietnamese Communist Party in December of 1959, roughly 1 year before the NLF was set up in South Vietnam to deceive the world, and 2 years before President Kennedy stepped up U.S. support for Diem with 685 advisors, and 4 years before our Vietnamese allies on the verge of defeat were saved by direct U.S. military intervention. These same generals now confirm what some of us had known from the very beginning, namely that the NLF was Hanoi's own artificial creation. Yet our media stars went on telling us for about 10 years that the NLF was an autonomous, politico-military entity independent of, even at times hostile to, Hanoi, and that we should be negotiating with them to preempt North Vietnam. And what did our media stars tell their readers and viewers and listeners when the NLF disappeared without a trace the day Hanoi's troops marched into Saigon? Strictly nothing. But those of us who did speak out on these critically important errors that were once sacred articles of faith were either ignored or excoriated as mindless anti-communists. We all remember the Ho Chi Minh trails, which Hanoi insisted for years were a figment of the CIA's imagination and part of a campaign to discredit the spontaneous, self-sustaining, anti-fascist revolution in the South. Well, since then, we have learned from present and former communist leaders in Vietnam that these trails were begun 4 years before U.S. military intervention. Propaganda, disinformation, and irresponsible journalism played a major role in our defeat. Vietnamese defectors have confirmed this. Stanley Kano himself, while researching the PBS series, wrote from Saigon, I beg your pardon, Ho Chi Minh City, that a former Time magazine staff correspondent, Pham Xuan An, a Vietnamese national, had been a North Vietnamese intelligence officer throughout his employment with America's most influential weekly magazine, and was now a colonel in the communist regime's security service. The Columbia Review of Journalism did a piece on this communist intelligence officer, which quoted his former American colleagues as saying that he was a jolly good fellow, and an objective reporter who did not try to mislead his U.S. employer or any of his media colleagues. The only dissenting quote you will find in that piece of terminal naivete, was one from me. And speaking of terminal naivete, my dear friend and former boss, Osborne Elliott, now dean of the Columbia School of Journalism, wrote in his memoirs titled The World of Oz, published in 1980, and I quote, "The postmortems on Vietnam are still continuing as this is being written, 1979, with the Shawcrosses and Kissingers doing battle and many others yet to be heard from. I concluded rather belatedly that it was a tragic misadventure. Others have yet to be convinced. In December of 78, I happened upon General Westmoreland at a resort hotel in Florida where he was attending an economic conference. I asked him if he thought the Vietnam War had ever been winnable. Yes, he said firmly. And when might that have been, I inquired. After the Tet Offensive in 68. In Westmoreland's view, Elliot concludes, not without sarcasm, Tet had actually been a great military defeat for the communists, and the American media had totally misrepresented the affair, unquote. Well, Elliot wondered what Westy had been smoking. And yet that is precisely what happened. I'm sure you all remember how the communist Tet Offensive in Vietnam in 68 was instantly and almost unanimously described by the media as an unmitigated disaster for the United States, and how President Johnson subsequently felt compelled to abdicate. Well, Trong Nhu Thanh, the former Minister of Justice of the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam and one of its founders, escaped, as you may remember, among the boat people and wrote a piece in October of 82 titled The Myth of Liberation. And this former puppet of Hanoi revealed, and I quote, "The Tet Offensive proved catastrophic to our plans. It is a major irony of the Vietnamese War that our propaganda, which of course includes disinformation operations, transform this military debacle into a brilliant victory, giving us new leverage in our diplomatic efforts, inciting the American anti-war movement to even stronger resistance, and disheartening the Washington planners, unquote. So much for Peter Brestrup's contention that the media was not manipulated. After Tet, Newsweek indulged in a major piece of advocacy journalism and announced that the consensus among the senior editors was that we had been defeated and that the time had come to cut our losses. I was a senior editor at the time, in fact, the only one who was stationed abroad, and I happened to have covered the Tet Offensive. I was not consulted about this consensus. I had in my files, which I still possess for my memoirs, reported Tet as a major disaster for Hanoi, but my reporting was spiked and did not appear that particular week in any shape, manner, or form. And speaking about the anti-war movement in the U.S., I had dinner with the Agence France-Presse correspondent, the only Western correspondent based in Hanoi, when I was back there in 1979. And he informed me that his other guests would be Wilfred Burchett, the late Australian-born, well-known KGB agent, and two French communists, who, he said, were the only two Westerners working for the Hanoi regime at that time, one of them in the, quote, information, unquote, ministry. This particular fellow, my French host explained in advance, had been expelled from Saigon for desecrating the South Vietnamese War Memorial. It was a famous incident at the time, but the man was never described as a member of the French Communist Party, which indeed he was and still is. Anyway, these two French guests assumed that if I was in Hanoi, I had to be part of the leftist mafia from Europe. I introduced myself in French with my last name, as is the custom in French, and used the French pronunciation of my name. And it didn't seem to ring a bell, and as Burchett had not yet arrived, they did not realize that they were supposed to be discreet in my presence. After a few bottles of wine, they became quite boisterous and began reminiscing about their exploits in the United States. When I inquired as tactfully as possible about what they had been doing in the U.S., they looked at me as if I was some kind of twittering half-moron for not knowing about these legendary heroes. Burchett, who had arrived in his cups, tried to make sure they did not answer my question by kicking them under the table. I know this because he missed them and was kicking me instead. So the two Frenchmen plunged ahead. They had gone to the U.S., they told me, with tourist visas to help the agitation and propaganda in Jane Fonda's campaign against the Vietnam War. And this was the only vignette spiked from the story that I wrote about my trip to Hanoi for Newsweek, which appeared as a two-page feature in the domestic edition and as a three-page feature in the overseas editions. Don Graham of the Washington Post wrote me a letter to congratulate me on what he described as the best article he had read on Vietnam since the end of the war, but the key vignette was missing. When Edith Efron wrote the News Twisters, which some of you may remember, in 1971, she raised some very disturbing questions about the leftist bias of TV news reporting. And everyone from Dr. George Weinberg, then a radical writer for the Underground Press, to Bill Buckley, said that it was a fantastic shocker of a book that would have historic impact on broadcast journalism. Well, it didn't. Things have gotten worse. The Spike and Monimbo, Target America, and the Coercive Utopians, and more recently, Disinformatia, by two scholars, both of them Democrats, hopefully raise the level of awareness about disinformation and censorship by omission. But these books certainly did not stem the tide. This can only be done by the president. By the president on national TV, focusing on the more brazen examples of hostile disinformation in our media that have been swallowed by our democratic friends and incorporated in their party platform as so many received ideas and articles of faith. Shirley Christian, who won the Pulitzer Prize for Latin American reporting in the Miami Herald in 1981, demonstrated in that piece that she wrote for the Washington Journalism Review in March of 82 that much of the media's output in Central America is dominated by a style of reporting that grew out of Vietnam. She explained how her colleagues covering the Nicaraguan Revolution had played up, or rather played down, the Marxist proclivities of the revolutionaries and played up, all evidence to the contrary notwithstanding, their alleged democratic pluralistic principles. And this is the climate of conformity and received ideas in which Soviet and Soviet proxy disinformation operations thrive so successfully. Disinformation operations change the course of history of the Vietnam War and of history since then. The fall of Saigon, as you may recall, was quickly followed up by the introduction of Soviet-Cuban proxy troops into Angola a few months later, Ethiopia the following year, in 76, then a Marxist coup in South Yemen, which has now become a major Soviet base in the southwestern corner of the Arabian Peninsula, the Marxist coup in Afghanistan in April of 78, the invasion of that country by the Soviets late in 1979. Tang, in his article, The Myth of Liberation, said that Vietnam is now an instrument of Soviet expansionism in Southeast Asia. There are 10,000 Soviets there today. And Tang describes the very same leaders that we were negotiating with over a decade ago as bloodthirsty tyrants. The Central American drama and the role disinformation is playing in laying the groundwork for yet another U.S. strategic defeat is almost identical to what I observed in Vietnam. For 3 years now, the media has ridiculed the Reagan administration whenever it stated, quite accurately, that Cuba and Nicaragua were supplying the guerrillas in El Salvador. Reporters came back from guided tours with the Marxist-led guerrillas and assured us that most of their weapons had been captured from the U.S.-supplied government forces. So Congress decided there was no further justification for aid to the anti-communist resistant fighters in Nicaragua. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union, Cuba, and Nicaragua can continue to back with impunity the revolutionaries in El Salvador, a country that has held three free elections in 2 years. A former Salvadoran guerrilla leader, Alejandro Montenegro, who was captured in Honduras, has testified that the majority of the arms that he received in the rebel units that he commanded came from Nicaragua. Montenegro confirmed that he had disinformed visiting journalists as to the origin of his weapons and about the guerrilla's main headquarters not being in Nicaragua, which indeed it is. I mention this latest case of flagrant disinformation because it illustrates starkly, dramatically, how the media play a very large part in shaping foreign policy or the lack thereof, and how Congress, whose perceptions are largely shaped by the media, goes about undercutting the executive in the exercise of its principal responsibility, namely national and international security. A well-orchestrated international network of disinformation fronts, take a good look at the activities of CISPAS, a Cuban front organization, continues to deluge the media and the Congress with material designed to generate support for the Marxist-led guerrillas and to discredit U.S. policies. Many journalists and assorted intellectuals, and I'm not confusing the two, heaven forbid, make it their duty to transform our sworn enemies into misunderstood innocents and to portray our own leaders as the foes of democracy and freedom. I watched this happen in Vietnam, and I'm watching a replay of the same sinister process in Central America. On February 10th, 1982, the Wall Street Journal devoted an extraordinary 1,500-word editorial to the brazen disinformation campaign going on in our media over El Salvador, even citing by name, which I'd never seen done during the Vietnam War, reporters from the New York Times and the Washington Post. In a major address in December of 81, Attorney General Bill French Smith said that perhaps the most insidious aspect of Soviet bloc espionage operations in the U.S. was the threat posed by hostile active measures, which are aimed at influencing public opinion and the political process through disinformation and agents of influence. Communist disinformation specialists are given more credence by the media than either the U.S. government or the government that it is supporting, even though these disinformation specialists have been trained to believe that anything that advances the cause of communism is automatically the truth, and anything that retards it becomes an untruth. For a Marxist to lie, and to lie convincingly, as Lenin once said, is not only a sign of intelligence, but an imperative when furthering a revolutionary cause. The media's own defense is that they are simply messengers of bad news who do not have their own agenda and who, as in olden days, have their heads cut off because the leaders don't like what they have to report. Well, that is hypocritical, sanctimonious twaddle. Twaddle in all its unrationed splendor. Messengers of bad news indeed. Jonathan Quitney, an investigative reporter for the Wall Street Journal, recently published a venomously anti-American book titled Endless Enemies. And the Washington Post reviewer said that Quitney goes beyond the standard liberal line by saying that Moscow's record stacks up as less threatening than the U.S. record. Seymour Hersh, the investigative reporter on the radical left, who wrote the hatchet job on Henry Kissinger called The Price of Power, is now busy on another book that will purport to prove that the shooting down of KL's Flight 007 last September 1st by the Soviet Air Force was a CIA plot from beginning to end. $400,000 advance. These are the people spreading the plague of self-hatred who would not question the original report that the plot to kill the Pope had originated with a group of neo-Nazi Turks known as the Grey Wolves, but automatically scoff at the Bulgarian connection, even though it is the subject of a 25,000-word report by the very courageous Italian magistrate in charge of the case. To be told that the PBS series is an objective, retrospective look at the Vietnam War is an insult to one's intelligence. Andrew Pearson, a film journalist in Vietnam from 63 to 72, produced episode 5 of the PBS series. He is also a contributor to the first issue of Intervention, a new far-left quarterly put out by the Military Studies Center. And who do we find on the board? Richard Barnett of IPS, Dan Ellsberg, Gloria Emerson, Peter Arnett of CNN, who spent a decade or more as the top AP man in Vietnam, Congressman Tom Downey, and Peter Davis, producer of Hearts and Minds, formerly with CBS, who also did the selling of the Pentagon. A 13-hour series that devotes 3 minutes to the victims of the victorious Vietnamese's gulag system of re-education centers, 4.5 minutes to the boat people, and 4.5 minutes to Pol Pot's genocide of one-third of the Cambodian people, cannot by the remotest stretch of the imagination be considered unbiased, undistorted, fair, and objective. La Fontaine noted that every editor pays tribute to the devil. Even with the current rate of inflation, the amount of tribute paid has become excessive. And a corrective answer is long overdue. Thank you very much.